Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back again. I wanted to let you all know, those of you who are concerned about family and friends in Boston, before we do our underwriting and introduce our guest, that the mayor's hotline in Boston is 617-635-4500. We know two confirmed dead in those explosions. I told you earlier there was confirmation there was an explosion at the JFK Library. That was the third bomb that went off. These were bombs, they're saying, that were small bombs, that they were either in a briefcase or they were in a backpack. They're not sure what. They were not car bombs. No one's claimed credit for these bombings. They said they've done them. But that we are we're waiting for this news to erupt. As soon as it does, we will let you know. President Barack Obama is about to address the nation. If he does, we will break in and try to pull that up and let you hear it live if possible. So ask people to keep an eye on that. If President Obama does address the nation on these things, we'll let you hear that. We will stay on top of this. It looks like people don't know whether it was a terrorist bombing or just some maniac, but clearly were planted bombs, and we were going to find out what happens. And those are the numbers to call. You can also go, by the way, let me give you this other website once again, besides that telephone number, is safeandwell.community.org, which is the Red Cross website. And they also have information there. And as we hear more, we will let you know what is going on. And let me just, one more thing just came in. Let me double check before we jump into our conversation. No, there's nothing there. Okay, so just that, no, that's fine. I thought it was something about, just that was about Baltimore again, people being safe there. And we may have, during the course, is a conversation, folks from the Baltimore team who were there when the explosions took place, just to talk to us for a few minutes, but we'll tell you more as we know it. Okay. Go to our conversation here in studio, let me move this other way so I can actually see all my guests. There we go. Aha, good to see you. So we are about to have a conversation here about the controversy around liquor stores in Baltimore, liquor stores in certain communities. There are liquor stores that are supposed to, or people argue, that were zoned incorrectly, that they're in people's neighborhoods where they should not be allowed. And that some of these places that they're saying are not really bars, they are just convenience stores, and they are selling alcohol and liquors. Though many people in the people who own these stores are arguing, look, we bought these licenses. No one at the time said that we weren't allowed to have them. So now you're telling us we have to lose our businesses. There's that side of the discussion as well. There are also issues we want to raise. We've been asking people all over about, which have to do with where these licenses come from in the first place. How were they obtained? We know how liquor board works in our state. State senators suggest nominations for the board, and those are the people who usually get in. It's a very political organization. It always has been. We did talk to the liquor board. The liquor board said to us, this is a zoning problem, not our problem, but they're also probably worrying about their own audit that came through, and we'll talk a bit about that today, too, that report that just came out. Many of us who grew up here, I was thinking back to the late 50s, early 60s, and through the 60s, that both the neighborhoods I ran in a lot, Ashland Avenue on the east side, and Park Heights, by Park Heights Terrace, where my grandparents lived between Pimlico and Park Heights itself, right by the old theater, these stores didn't exist. There was Hoffman's Liquors on the corner, one of the first bars in Baltimore to integrate racially, but there weren't tons of licenses around. Where did they come from? And other people would argue, look, what are you trying to say, that it's only people in wealthy neighborhoods that can walk to a store and buy a bottle of beer or a bottle of wine? So we can talk about all that during the course of this hour. We are joined here in studio by Julius Colon, who is president and CEO of Park Heights Renaissance. Julius, good to see you again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jay Chung is with us in studio. He is manager of the Charles Village Shop. His family owns that store. That store has been, in one hand or another, when I lived there 40 years ago, it was there. So good to have you in the studio, Jay. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Sean Malone is with us, legal representative for the KGRO, the Korean American Grocers and Licensed Beverage Association of Maryland, and a lawyer with Harris Jones and Malone. And Sean, good to have you in the studio. It's been a while.
Thanks for having me. I actually represent the Korean American Coalition for Fair Zoning. It's a little different than KGRO.
Let me write that down, for fair zoning.
All their members are members of KGRO, but they are.
But that's who you represent.
That's who we represent, yes.
Korean Americans for Fair Zoning. Gotcha. All right. Let me write that down. Make sure I have that right.
I'll call him the coalition.
Okay, good. Dr. Deborah Verholden is with us. It's been a while since he's been in the studio. Assistant professor, associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Good to have you back in the studio with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Mel Freeman, who we talked today, Executive Director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association, who's been following this very closely. And Mel, good to have you in the studio.
Thanks, Mark.
So let's talk about what are the underlying issues here. This is, I looked at the map of all the stores that people want to close across the city from east to west. Most of them are in either in the west side and around Park Heights or in the west side neighborhoods, in the poorest communities on the west side, in Councilman Welsh district, for the most part, when it comes to the city, or they're on the east side, right over by Hopkins Hospital, again, in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Baltimore, and some stuck there in the middle, like Jay's Shop, which is in the heart of Charles Village. So can we talk for a moment to the heart of what we think this is all about? What is at the heart of this and where this controversy erupted from?
Yeah, I think first let's just make sure we got all the pieces of it straight.
Go ahead.
So you asked where the licenses came from. So the number of licenses has remained pretty constant over time. We actually have a moratorium on licenses. The issue is when the number of licenses was sort of established, we were a city of 1 million. So people left Baltimore. They didn't take their liquor stores with them. They didn't take their houses with them. We got a lot of vacant houses. We have more liquor stores than we need to actually serve our population if you use any metric that's available in sort of the national arena. We have about twice as many liquor stores as we need for the population. We've shrunk by almost 400,000 people in the last 40 years, but we haven't lost one liquor license. So this bill, in one way,
have we gained liquor licenses?
We have gained some liquor licenses. The most of the licenses that we gained are not being impacted by this. But in my opinion, this is almost a right-sizing issue. We're right-sizing the number of liquor stores to our population. But I want to be really clear. This is a zoning issue. What zoning is saying is what buildings can be located where. So I don't think any of us would disagree that generally, we don't want liquor stores next to where people live. We don't want liquor stores next to playgrounds. We don't want liquor stores next to schools. So that's the first piece of legislation, is saying that liquor stores shouldn't be in residential communities. That was a decision that was made back in 1971. It's just no one enforced it. We're now getting a bit more aggressive about actually enforcing what's been on the books since 1971. The second thing is we've got a lot of liquor stores that are just packaged goods stores parading as taverns. So we've said the other thing is if you are zoned for a building that's designed for on-premise consumption, then you then must operate as a business consistent with that. And then the third piece is we've got liquor stores piled on top of each other. We just want to space them out. You have to be at least 300 feet away from the nearest liquor store. And that's really impacting new places that are going in. So to me, on its face, none of these things all seem reasonable. I mean, they're just, you know, what the city is now and what it needs to look like in this particular area to be right-sized and to be consistent with public health.
A couple
Go
of
ahead.
Things.
Jay Chung.
Yes. A couple of things. First off, when these stores were grandfathered in 1971, the new zoning lines were drawn around the stores. So at that time, the city decided that these stores shouldn't lose their businesses, and those stores were specifically exempted at that time. It's not that the law wasn't enforced on those stores. It's those stores were specifically grandfathered. Now, speaking to the number of liquor stores, yeah, if you go to the Small Business Administration and ask them, what's your number one retail store that you would support or give loans out to easily? And they say, we love liquor stores. That's a straight quote from Small Business Administration loan officials. That's because stores that sell liquor pay back all their loans.
Because they make a lot of money.
No, they make consistent money. They survive. That's why none of them have died out over the years. Because even though they may lose some business over time, having that license enables them to sell those products as well as other grocery products. I sell Ben & Jerry's ice cream, paper towels, toilet paper.
Can I ask a question? Let's jump in here. But I mean, this is just I've been in your store. I know your store.
Oh, great.
It's been a while, but I know your store. And the store you have, as someone said today, I think Mel might even said it to me on the phone today, your store is like a place caught in the middle of a firing line because it's been around forever. It's changed hands. It's remained inside the community. But what you're describing is not the case in most stores.
No. Each store is going to be different. Each neighborhood is going to be different.
But there's a general consensus.
Right. But you were talking about the specific laws regarding zoning, and those stores were specifically exempted at that time. So the way you phrased it earlier, it made it sound as though those stores were in violation the whole time. They were exempted from.
But we made the decision in 1971 that we didn't want liquor stores in residential neighborhoods, and no one was willing to deal with the issue of then what about the stores that are already there. I don't think anybody at the time expected that not one of those stores would go away in the 41 years between or 42 years between now and then.
Mel was trying. Let me get Mel jump in.
I just wanted to go back to Jay's point about the items that he sells. Yes, Jay is caught in the middle of a big blanket that we need desperately in some neighborhoods. There are neighborhoods where a pint of, what ice cream was that again?
Ben and Jerry's.
Ben and Jerry's would not be found anywhere near the liquor stores. And these are stores that are in neighborhoods that have just been issues and problems and loitering and trash and crime for years, for 41 years. And neighborhoods have had to fight tooth and nail to try and keep their neighborhoods straight and clean. And these other stores are not helping.
Let me talk specifically about our community, which is the Park Heights community. Park Heights has right now, between Northern Parkway and Druid Hill, Wabash and Green Spring, it has close to 40 liquor establishments, 1,500 acres. When you were talking about earlier that you grew up in that area and your family grew up in that area, and Hoffman's was only one of the liquor stores in that area, now within a 100 feet away from each other, you have three other liquor establishments. So that you have a community now that is 30,000, that at one time was 60,000+, 30,000, and where most of the crime occurs and safety issues are around liquor establishments. Now, some of these liquor stores that have been listed as part of because of the zoning issue, it's unfortunate that some of the good establishments, the better establishments, because some of the ones we have in Park Heights are not some of the better establishments. You walk in, and it's like bulletproof glass. The residents will tell you it's not friendly to the community. But at the same time, to deal with the issue of when you're talking about trying to revitalize a neighborhood that has been, somewhat destroyed, the destruction that has occurred in Park Heights can be attributed to a lot of the liquor establishments, not just liquor stores, but also the lounges that exist there that front as lounges and their package. They sell more packaged goods than they sell anything else. So the residents in Park Heights have come together to talk about how we can change the issues with respect to how the establishments operate in Park Heights. And we were able to change the laws back in 2010 to have the liquor establishments open at 9 o'clock in the morning versus 6 o'clock in the morning.
Without a doubt, many of the communities in Baltimore have significant social issues that they're facing. And I think what the Hopkins study showed is there's a correlation amongst liquor stores and the density of the location with some of those areas. What they have not shown, and which is that they have, and nor has anyone testified to a direct causation. And that's what's missing here. You could also do the same type of overlay in Baltimore with poverty. You could do it with church storefront churches. You could do the same type of things and say, well, if we get rid of these things, then the world will be sunny. That's simply not the case. And I think with this, we are taking a very broad policy and having a significant impact on many very good, longstanding businesses. But more importantly, what is concerning to my clients, I represent about 84 Class A liquor licenses, which will be affected by this. It's just in flat violation of longstanding Supreme Court law. In Vic Woe v. Hopkins, a longstanding case going back to San Francisco when they decided they would shut down Chinese laundries, the court ruled that even if a ordinance is, if it is on its face race neutral, but it has a racially discriminatory application or effect, it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And that's what ultimately is the road we're going down if we don't do something in a more targeted fashion. The real issue here is not nonconforming uses. The real issue that we're dealing with here is bad actors. And those bad actors, I think, as Mr. Clone would agree, we've had this conversation, are both in nonconforming and conforming uses.
I disagree wholeheartedly. This is not about race. This is not about race. It's about zoning. The race issue to me that's most glaring is that the majority of these stores are located in predominantly poor African-American communities. And that issue around race has never been brought up.
But
that's the real race issue. This is not a race issue. This is about zoning.
I know you'd like to, I know you would like that to be the case. But the reality is if you take a facially neutral statute and you apply it in a racially discriminatory fashion, it violates the Equal Protection Clause. And in with regard to this of Class A licenses, we're talking about over 83% are owned by Korean business owners.
Because they own over 83% of the licenses.
And in
I mean,
in
they've
San
chosen
Francisco.
To corner this market. And so I don't have a problem with that. But the reality of it is that.
I encourage you to read
the question becomes, though, right, the argument about the future of these communities and also the men and women who took money out to buy these stores and run these stores. So these are two things that are
And they've opted to open these stores in predominantly poor African-American communities, and no one's talking about that. I mean, it's just offensive that you would make this a race argument about some kind of discrimination against the retailers when the retailers have elected and created an enclave for themselves in this business. And I don't have a problem with that. But they've chosen to locate themselves in predominantly poor African-American communities like Park Heights, where people have very little ability to rally and get their needs met. And so this is an attempt to bring some parity to the table, so that poor people who don't rally as well for themselves still have some protection under the law, which is being universally applied. We're not saying we're going to treat the Korean-American owners one way and the non-Korean-American owners another way. We're saying we just got to deal with an issue that's an obvious, glaring threat to public health and public safety in Baltimore.
So there are communities in Baltimore, and I know of some means, that have wine stores, liquor establishments in their communities,
mm-hmm.
whether it's in the middle of Hamden, which is now becoming an up-and-coming neighborhood, the wine stores, right. and other stores, mm-hmm. or the one in Medfield that some people are trying to close. The neighbors want to keep it open because it's their neighborhood wine store. They want to be able to walk to it and not have to drive somewhere to get to their store. So it becomes also, this issue becomes of the complexities here of class and race and community do mesh. They do hit each other,
mm-hmm.
because people in Hamden are not going to say close the wine stores. We don't want it here in our neighborhood, even though it's next door, even though it's two blocks away from a school. They don't want that closed. They want it open.
But there are
issues here that are beyond just simple zoning issues. It seems to me.
Right, they are, and it's interesting that in where Park Heights is situated, this area of Park Heights. That north of Northern Parkway, you have one liquor establishment, and it closes at 9 o'clock mm-hmm. in the evening. You have in Roland Park, which is also an adjacent neighborhood, it closes at 9 o'clock at Eddie's. So that, again, when we talk about where these liquor establishments exist, they are predominantly in certain communities that don't need the saturation of that type of liquor establishment. So that I understand that, you know, the clashing between, you know, I put all this money out, you know, for this business and versus, you know, how am I going to get compensated? And that's a big issue right now, compensation. But the reality is that these communities are dying, okay? And how do we save these communities? And if one of the issues is the saturation of liquor establishments, then we have to address them.
Jay, before we go to the phones here, we're going to write the phones, but Jay, go ahead. I know you have a response.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Into the mic, yeah, so they can get your voice. There you go.
Sorry. One of the things that the doctor mentioned about this being a purely zoning matter, and on one hand, we're being told that when the law is being put forth, but then most of the arguments that we're hearing outside of that is that it's not a zoning issue. It's a health issue. It's a crime issue. And one of the studies that is on the Baltimore City website says the I'll quote here. In this study, off-premise alcohol sales outlets and on-premise alcohol sales outlets were associated with a 1.67% increase and a 2.06% increase in violence rates, respectively. Now, earlier, I think Mr. Cologne had said that most of the crime happens around the liquor stores. Now, that's an exaggeration. A 1.67% increase number. Obviously, Park Heights throws the numbers off, and it's not representative of the entire city. And that goes to the heart of the matter.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification, because it is true.
But let me let you finish this thought.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Keep getting interrupted. So each of these stores, and Mr. Colon has admitted before, that many of the stores that need to go in the city aren't on the list. Many of the stores that people want are on the list. No one thinks this is a good solution. But it's being pushed forward because of political motivations.
So what is a good solution?
I have a special fund.
I want Mel to answer that same question.
I have a couple of ideas that no one wants to listen to in the past.
How about self-policing? How about you guys do a better job of policing each other like they do in San Francisco?
We tried.
Because you know who the bad actors are, but you
step right
over
it. Do you know how many funerals my parents have had to go to of store owners? Do you have any idea that
I've
most Koreans?
I've gone to just as many from residents. Yes, I do. I get
how
it.
Many? Oh, but as a percentage of people who work those jobs, other than taxi drivers, being a store owner in this city is the most dangerous civilian job. I know so many people who've been shot have gone to the hospital, or we even have a special fund for funerals for other business owners. I don't know too many other business owners and communities that have something like that. And policing the stores, do you know what it's like to walk to your car from the store? Every night I have to do a perimeter check. I have to take a look, make sure no one's hiding by my car. Because, yeah, we've had violence. I've had a grenade placed in front of me. I've had a knife pulled on me, gun pulled on me. I've been gang tackled by 7 Crip wannabes who wanted to steal some liquor. And I consider myself a bit of a tough guy. I'll go out there. I've testified for every criminal case. I've gone to Wabash Avenue at the courthouse numerous times to make sure that the criminals and the defense attorneys know that I'm there to testify. And I do everything I can. Not all store owners can do that. They're afraid for their lives. If you go out there and chase out the wrong person, they will come back and shoot you, shoot your wife, shoot your kids. That's why they can't police those areas. And the word police, yeah, we have the police department for that.
No, I said self-policing, where you guys are policing each other, because we all know for a fact.
So I'm supposed to go to another person's store and police their store?
I didn't say police their store. You're an organization of owners. You know who the bad actors are. I know. I've done compliance checks.
Actually, I don't know all 700 owners of stores
in the city.
And
you guys call each other and say, hey, they just did underage sales attempts at our store. Make sure you tighten up the ship because they're probably coming over to you next. You guys have a network of how you interact and communicate with each other. You could also do that and deal with the bad actors. Perhaps then liquor stores wouldn't be such a target.
We can try. And a couple of ideas on how to target those specific stores. We can identify all the bad stores, whether they're in commercial districts or in residential districts in the store, put them in a special tier. And in this city, there are many restaurants that are trying to obtain liquor licenses. We can put up some sort of auction system where those restaurants can auction and put in a bid for those licenses. And I know those licenses don't interchange between Class A's and restaurant licenses. But with this amount of public support, I think we can get the liquor board and the state legislature to get behind something like that. Now, we would reduce the number of Class A packaged goods stores and, you know, supply those liquor licenses for those restaurants.
We have to take a brief break, and we'll come back and we'll kind of respond to this. And Pamela and Derek are on the line here, and Will's on the line. We're going to get your calls as well. I want Mel's thoughts on this, and is there a way through this? Some people have argued, can these stores go through a transition where they sell different things other than liquor in these communities? Is that a possibility? 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late, don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. We're talking about the very controversial discussion going on in our city now about zoning and stores that sell liquor, and they're being closed en masse across the city. We are here with Jay Chung, who is manager of the Charles Village Schnapp Shop. He owns the his family owns that store. Sean Malone's here. He's legal representative of the Korean Americans for Fair Zoning. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Good. Is a lawyer with Harris Jones and Malone. Dr. Deborah Furr Holden, associate professor of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Mel Freeman, executive director of the Citizens Planning and Housing Association. And Julius Colon, who is president and CEO of Park Heights Renaissance. Before we jump back into our guests, I promise our listeners they can come in. Let's go to 410-319-8888. Pamela, you've been holding on a while. You're on the air.
Good evening. Good evening, Mr.
Good evening.
Steiner. I absolutely love your show.
Thank you.
Good evening to all of your guests. This is a very serious topic that you're having today. And, you know, I often wonder, why are all the liquor stores in certain neighborhoods? I happen to live in Baltimore City, and I'm always having to clean up liquor bottles in front of my home. I manage a property in Pikesville, so therefore I travel Park Heights. From my home, I travel Park Heights straight up to Pikesville. Once you cross Northern Parkway, there are no liquor stores. But if you travel over to Righteous Town Road and you cross Northern Parkway, there are still liquor stores. So I do agree with your guest that I believe that people are very aware. These things are strategically placed. If you're in poor neighborhoods and the neighborhood is already declining, if we know that alcoholism is a disease, then why are we putting those liquor stores in those neighborhoods where people can't even get sufficient food because there are no major grocery stores there? So it's just a lot going on. I just want to continue to listen to your program, and I do pray that there is something going to be done by all the liquor stores that are targeted in certain areas, and I'll continue to listen to your show this evening.
Mel Freeman, during the break, picking up what Pamela was saying, we were having this discussion about what is really going on here. And I said that look, if this is about zoning, then what about all the wine stores and better-off neighborhoods that are right next to somebody's home or are two blocks from the school? They're not going to close. Or are they?
Based on the present zoning proposal, all stores are subject to this closing of selling alcohol in a neighborhood. As Jay mentioned, yeah, he has to be in that group. Everybody's in that group. We've got to have a fair plan right across the city. And the reason for that is there are neighborhoods that are suffering, and we have no tools to help them. You know, we've talked about the liquor board and them enforcing their rules. We just recently learned that that's not exactly a perfect system. We also talked about the fact that the police spend a great deal of resources bouncing back and forth from every single one of these stores, and I think it would be certainly nice if we took some of the stores away that they didn't have to respond to for the person lying on the street, on the stairs, with a bottle in their arms. You know, there's just way too many places for the police to have to go to keep track of all these stores. So it is our hope at CPHA that as we start to take apart some of these numbers of stores that are selling alcohol and work with them to make them become better neighborhood partners that are a convenience store or some other business where they're actually more than 5% of the neighborhood is their customers. Maybe we get approach 50% of the neighborhood as a customer if they had some fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, bread, milk, toilet paper in case it snows. But, you know, this is a really big issue in Baltimore, and it's the number one issue that citizen groups come to us and to the Community Law Center. We're constantly trying to fight or defend ourselves from a liquor store or a bar that is just not a good neighbor.
So since we've kind of established in some ways that if this is a zoning issue, then it does not mean, and I think you were talking about it during the break, Julius, I forget who said what right now, but that there are a lot of bad actors in, let's say, Park Heights who own stores who are not included in this for whatever reason, and people who are doing good jobs in the community that are included in this. So there's a question of, how do you create a system that's fair, that works for the community, and works for those business owners that are doing the right thing?
If we limit the number of the bad ones that are on neighborhood streets, then the police and the liquor board can respond to the correct number that are in the business districts.
And can you all define, from before we go back over here, what you mean by bad?
There are stores, and Jay, again, you're caught up in a bad industry here. There are liquor store owners that are still selling single cigarettes to everyone that walks in their door, which is illegal. They're selling all of the other drug paraphernalia.
Lucy's, as we call them.
Lucy's. Other drug paraphernalia. They are keeping individual, I would call them little drinking accounts in their stores for certain clientele. They're really feeding upon the alcoholism of these neighborhoods. And if there were the litter, the trash, the loitering, we can't go to the crime because you say the crime is sort of, you know, where is it here, where is it there, but it's certainly related to the stores.
Yeah, Deborah, if you own a typical liquor store, it's really interesting because as the kids grow up, the products catch them at eye level. So next time you go in a liquor store, Mark, just notice what's down at eye level are the candy bars, right, because that's where the little kids can see. And then about 6 to 12 inches above that are the cigarettes, because as they grow, they'll age into that. And then right above that is the liquor. And so this is just not – this is not what we need in our communities. And we actually have a law on the books right now passed by the city council last June that says no kids can make purchases in liquor stores anyway. And we know that our liquor store owners are not even operating consistent with that. And how I know is I personally visited every single store on the list. And I had my 11-year-old go with me, and she was able to make a purchase in all but 3 of the stores. So when we say bad actors, we've got people who operate above the law.
What did she buy?
She bought a candy bar. And it doesn't matter because she's not allowed by law to buy a candy bar in a liquor store because she's only 11.
Oh, my God. The world's going to end. An 11-year-old bought a candy bar in a store.
No, oh, my God. You don't follow the law. You're not above the law because you're a liquor store owner. You are bound by the law.
I can't sell a gallon of milk to a 17-year-old.
You absolutely cannot because that is
exactly,
the law.
Exactly.
And there are people who
here's
argue
what's
the
happened.
Same thing.
These same store owners, you know what I've heard? These kids were banging on the door with bricks, spray-painted their front signs. These store owners are getting victimized by these children because they weren't letting them in.
Because you want to sell liquor. If you weren't a liquor store, you could sell that kid a gallon of milk, a candy bar, a bag of chips, and all the other bad food.
Let me ask this question. What I want to know, and I'm going to open the phones back here again. Before these stores were liquor stores, what were they?
Well, for 30, 40 years, a lot of these licenses didn't just pop up. The professor's wrong. People didn't just relocate their stores to these neighborhoods.
I didn't say they
these
relocated.
Yes, you did.
These
did
stores
not.
Have been
you
in these early. Neighborhoods
I
for upwards of 30, 40 years. And its neighborhoods
I
have
did.
Evolved and changed. But they've been liquor stores, Mark. They've been.
Okay, so but it means that they've been liquor stores. If they're 30, 40 years ago, we're talking about they've been liquor stores since the 80s and 70s.
Oh, sure.
Not all of these licenses came from someplace.
Not all of them. Many of them, though.
Most
of them. Like I said, many of them were grandfathered in.
Were these stores that became liquor stores when the neighborhood became poor?
No. They've been a lot of these licenses, and there's a lot of misperceptions on this issue. But a lot of these licenses have been in families for 30, 40, 50 years. They've been in the same location, and they've been passed down through generations. And what we're really talking about, it's kind of a circular argument. We say we're clearly not going after bad actors. That's not what we're doing, although that is what we would all like to do. The real power to do that, and what we're doing is, in essence, we're using zoning law to try to affect what our liquor board isn't doing, which is effective enforcement
they don't do
and
much
license
of anything,
denial.
But
right.
Well,
yeah, that's another.
So. But this is what neighborhoods.
But that's the real way to correct the issue. Because
I'm sorry.
Let me
just open the phones here again. I think let's get Derek online, and you can also pull up Councilman Green Middleton, who's calling in as well. And Derek, welcome, Councilwoman. But Derek, go ahead. What was your question? You've been waiting a long time. Derek? Have him there? Okay. Councilman Green, Middleton, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome.
How are you?
I'm very well. Welcome.
Thank you.
So,
I've been, in fact, I'm sitting in my car right in the center of one of my districts, part of my district, Park Heights, on my way to a meeting to discuss an area to clean up with trash, and a lot of that is around the liquor stores. But I had to stop and make a call in because on my way here I was listening to your show, and just interesting conversation. There's a comment I would like to quickly make. I first want to thank you for bringing this issue on the air, and everyone sitting at that table knows me well. I just like to say that part of what's happening and what needs to happen with the owners of these liquor stores, especially in the Park Heights area, there has been, I've been a council member representing this area since 2007, and there has been literally no communication on this issue with me in trying to come to some negotiation or realization that, look, this community, there is going to be change. There, this community is in a state of revitalization, and I represent this neighborhood. I represent the businesses, and there has been literally, it's either when we, the two or three times that we have met, it's been their way or no way. We're starting food gardens. There's going to be change, and there's been proof that crime has been has happened around these neighborhoods. There's proof, and I walk in these places. There's proof that these lounges are not lounges. They don't want to talk to me because I know the truth.
So what would, very quickly before we get back to our studio guest here, Councilwoman, the only reason we didn't invite council people along is we thought you all were on city council tonight. We usually can't get folks on Mondays. But
right. We kind of got out early today.
Okay. I wish I'd known that. But at any rate, what would be a compromise? What do you mean by a compromise?
I communicate. Talk to us. We could sit at the table with ideas. This community has ideas to help them to participate in the change of this community. Not just change, participate in trying to come to these community meetings. There's a Park Heights Residents Council meeting every month. I have not seen one of the store owners come and talk and be a part of the community. They are not a part of the community.
Okay, Councilwoman, let me go back to our guests here. This is not the last show. We're going to do more shows on this, and we want you in the studio to have this conversation, maybe walk through the streets and
do that
as well.
I'll be happy to participate.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, get that information crossed.
All right.
I walk in these liquor stores. When I first came on board, I tried to help and fight, and I am so happy that this is taking place because there needs to be change, and that's what the realization. People have to come to that realization.
All right, Councilwoman Green, we have to move on, but I'm really glad you joined in. Thank you so much, Councilwoman. Derek has been trying to say something. One of our listeners, let him in. Come back to our panel. Derek, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mr. Steiner. How are you, sir?
Very well. Welcome. Go ahead.
Mr. Stein, I have to say that I am actually Lamar Shields' brother, so it is always a pleasure to hear you. And I just want to add a comment. I was waiting my turn because I really wanted to speak to the other issue. But I actually grew up in the with the historic Park Heights community, and moved in Park Heights in 1975. And I've watched the shift, and the number one thing that I would like to reiterate is what the last caller said, is that there's no relationship between the community and these liquor stores. If there was any semblance of relationships, then the store owners would take a greater responsibility in ensuring the safety of the community. But the relationship is ultimately through a 2.5-inch or 1.5-inch piece of glass. I wrote a poem in 1989 in my senior year of high school, and there was a line that says, where Korean merchants stand behind bulletproof glass, yet grow rich, bullets fly high and paralyze hopes and junkies ball up in fits. And I think that best describes that relationship, which is non-existent.
So, Derek, appreciate the call, and I'm just going to harken back to something else, back into when I was young. I was young once, and a lot of the corner stores were owned by people in the Jewish community, some of whom were deeply involved in the neighborhood, many of whom were not deeply involved in the neighborhood. there was also this kind of rift that took place at the same time. And so the kind of racial ethnic line is also part of the conversation. We heard it earlier in the show. To say it's not is also not real. But the question is there a way to make this work? Is there a way that stores can stay in business without selling liquor? Because do you need, what was the number you said in Park Heights?
Close to 40 liquor establishments.
And how many people?
30,000. That's it.
And in that small area, do we need that many liquor stores in small, poor, working-class communities that hardly have a grocery store? I mean, yeah, that's part of the problem.
Sure. And I think, I mean, a couple of things have been testified to at public hearings that there doesn't seem to be a lot of debate about. There is an oversaturation, and certainly Mr. Colon's neighborhood and area, there is an oversaturation of liquor stores. And through proper enforcement, we can lessen those through review of liquor license at renewal time. I think that additionally, what has been testified to is consumption is not going to decrease. No one's testified consumption is going to decrease. What you're going to take out some of the stores in Mr. Colon's neighborhood, but there is going to be, you know, still a significant amount of stores there. And so you may have some stores getting a bigger share of the market, but what you won't have is a reduction of consumption. You won't have a reduction of people hanging outside of liquor stores. You may have bigger crowds outside of stores, but you're not going to see a reduction. And that's the fallacy in the Hopkins study. There is no causation that's been shown. But you get to the heart of what you're asking. I think creative minds focused on the same issue, which is getting rid of liquor stores who are violating the law and hurting the community through enforcement, we can shut those down. When I was the chief legal counsel of the Baltimore Police Department, on a few occasions, we enforced the padlock law. We shut stores down. We shut down bars that were a nuisance in communities. But we don't use the padlock law anymore. It sits on the book. Without enforcement, probably since I left the police department in 2002, 2003.
So Mark,
we're building a coalition of community groups that are coming together that know this true impact in their neighborhoods. It's really tough to say that just because we've limited the number of stores doesn't mean we're going to make a difference. Limiting the number of stores is going to limit the number of police calls that are gone scattered all over town after every little store that's in a neighborhood. If it's at least on a business street in a main business district, at least the police are going to be there watching all the businesses and protecting everyone that's up on the main district. I'm not exactly buying the fact that if we limit the number of stores, we're not going to limit the number of issues that are going on.
Well, and the research is overwhelmingly clear. When you decrease the supply of alcohol, you do actually decrease consumption. But again, I don't want to get seduced into that pathway because that's not what this is about. This is about saying we don't want liquor stores in residential communities. And I want to go on record as saying this is one piece of a comprehensive rezoning of the city that's designed to make the city function well as the current city that we are, as well as into the future. Zoning is supposed to be a tool to help the city fit its current needs as well as move into the future. And that's what we're doing with this. And this piece is one piece of a much larger puzzle. So, yeah, it will decrease. I mean, that's what the research says. People have devoted their whole careers to this, and that is overwhelming.
It's not what the study says, and it's not what's been testified to.
You're talking about one study. I could cite 50 other studies.
Sure.
That
is. So if the zoning does go through, what do we expect to be in the next? What happens then? If these zoning measures do go through, literally happens? I mean,
For Park Heights, it means six less liquor establishments in Park Heights.
But not necessarily
again,
bad ones.
Not necessarily. Right. Okay, true.
We will develop other strategies outside of zoning to deal with that. The thing that I think that this is really great is it's actually brought some dialogue to the table that's much needed. We have an ineffective liquor board. We have community that has had no voice in this up to this point, and we have owners who've had the luxury of going to their stores and going home. Now, all of a sudden, they're out at the meetings, they're at hearings, they're out now. So this is great. We need this dialogue.
It's very luxurious to work 80 to 90 hours a week, week in, week out, 52 weeks a year. Some of these people work 7 days a week for 10 years at a stretch with no vacation, no days off. Yeah, that's a great luxury. some of your...
I left my three children at home. I'm not getting paid to be here. So the advocacy piece...
I'm not paid here either.
The advocacy piece is all-consuming as well. I've devoted my life and my professional career to public health and public safety.
The reality is, though, that this is the only part of the zoning code that violates equal protection law. I think what's going to happen is this. If it passes, and the votes are close right now, but if this part of the plan passes... there will be there's going to be a phase out period for these stores, and you'll have abandoned buildings where there used to be a business, but you will see before that happens a test of the statute.
Let me open the phone show again. 410-319-8888. A lot of callers. See if we can get a few callers in a row here. Will, you're on the air.
Good afternoon to all you guys. This is Will Hanna.
Hi, Will. How are you?
I'm doing well. Here's the part of the problem. Is, as the councilwoman said, there's not a lot of people that have, not a lot of businesses that have been included in a lot of this conversation. And in our estimation, this is not a zoning problem. This is an accountability problem. We have people that consume alcohol. We reduce six liquor stores in the Park Heights community. Is that going to stop the percentage of people that consume alcohol in communities from consuming alcohol? No, it's not. It's not going to change that one bit. The problem is, that you don't have a comprehensive plan to get rid of, to address the human issue of the consumption of alcohol. That's the problem. You cannot rezone your way to fixing that problem. All you're going to do in rezoning is you're going to make a lot of people upset. You're going to make a lot of people mad. You're going to get rid of six liquor stores that aren't even the most egregious violators in Park Heights. And in Park Heights, you have one block in the 5200 block of Park Heights Avenue, where there are four liquor stores. None of those stores are scheduled to be closed because they're zoned C1. If you're taking the zoning issue and saying, okay, if you're zoned R6, we're going to take away even the fee codes, and we're going to take these stores that are zoned R6, and we're going to make them the ones that we're going to get rid of.
So what would be the alternative, real quick?
The alternative is do what we did do in Park Heights. That was effective. Mm-hmm. If you have a problem where you have people that are consuming or standing around outside and the criminal element that exists outside the store, Mr. Cologne can attest to this as well. Well, we had a problem at Park Heights and Hayward. What we did was we did an agreement with that establishment, which was the Blue Caribbean. Did a covenant with the community, with that establishment, so they wouldn't sell anything in that establishment to anyone under 21 years old. They took away the candy bars, the cigarettes, the cigars, all of those things. Anything that anybody under 21 would come and buy. You know what happened on Park Heights and Hayward? You can drive past there right now. There's no one standing outside. No one.
Okay,
so
well,
you have to look at it from a reverse strategy.
All right, well, we're almost out of time here, so I've got to come back to our panel, come back to the caller, but we'll have you on in the next go-round here in the studio as well. We just couldn't fit everybody in at one time. Mel, you were about to say something.
We can't just go off and pick good ones and bad ones. That will definitely be a problem. We need a tool. These neighborhoods are suffering. This is just one other item that we can help save some families in these communities. We can't pick off the good ones. You can't pick off the bad ones. We need to just take the liquor stores out of the neighborhoods.
So I think most people would concur that the corner stores selling liquor in poor neighborhoods have to be dealt with. This is overwhelming, and it's overwhelming. On the other hand, to say the only way you can do it is through zoning, which means the good actors get thrown out while bad actors can stay because they're zoned differently, there's something skewed about that too.
If they're good actors, there are opportunities to relocate, and they're going to know what's going to be a good business practice and go find a great location.
The liquor board representative came out at the last planning meeting and said specifically that it's nearly impossible to move a license.
The same organization that barely polices now.
Yeah.
But it is true. I mean, it is nearly impossible to move a license from a non-conforming store. That's the whole purpose of it, is that once that establishment goes, the liquor license dies.
But their business can remain open.
Right. And the alternative business plans the planning department suggested for liquor stores was, on a PowerPoint presentation, an adult daycare center, an art gallery, a regular daycare center, and there were a couple other more ridiculous suggestions.
Why are those ridiculous?
Well, I'm sure liquor store owners can easily transfer the business practice.
Not
so that's what they were suggesting.
I just want to say one thing. With respect to when we talk about the issue of race came up earlier, And talking about the Asian population that is going to be hardly hit with respect to these liquor establishments, they're good business individuals. Why can't they open up cleaners or grocery stores or other businesses that we know they're very successful in, so that when these liquor establishments do close, why can't they find an alternative? Why can't in Park Heights we need some good cleaners? We need some good, you know, stores, food stores. Why couldn't there be an alternative to that?
Because the money that was invested in the liquor stores, they're not getting anything out of it, so they can't reinvest that money into a dry cleaner or any other type of business.
Well, when is the decision being made on this?
Oh, it probably the city council is now will start doing hearings. They're probably gonna do tests. Next year, this probably won't get voted on until next year.
So
I hope not.
Well, let's come back to this in the next couple of weeks and keep this sure. And keep this going. I think it's an important subject to have in the air. And bring some other players in as well. I want to apologize to my callers. We didn't get three or four of them in because there's so many guests. But we wanted to have a wide variety of guests, at least in our first foray into this, because it is a deeply important subject for the future of our communities. I want to thank them all for being here. Jay Chung, Sean Malone, Julius Colon, Dr. Deborah Verholden, and Mel Freeman. Good to have you all here. We will have website information for people's organizations if they exist. And we'll come back to this one. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks, Adams.
On the way out of here, I remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. www.mecu.com. And tomorrow night, Live Youngblood, a documentary that explores the struggle to curtail youth violence in our communities, will premiere tomorrow, April 16th, here at Morgan State University in the new Communications Building, Room 101. Doors open at 6 p.m. Screening begins at 7. I moderate a panel discussion afterwards. The film was produced by one of my producers, Bobby Marvin Holmes, so I look forward to that tomorrow night here at Morgan State University. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Lila Warshaw. Our theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear his show again, podcast, and of our past shows, please come to our website, steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Stay tuned for Keep It Moving. Take care.